looking to the stars in 2017. Many in Maine are fortunate to be able to look to the skies at night and see a spectacular starscape. In 2016, various supermoons and blood moons made headlines and had many of us craning our necks skyward to witness the beauty of our closest celestial body. In the year ahead, there'll be plenty more happening outside of Earth's orbit to keep the amateur astronomer enthralled. The spacecraft Juno will complete its first full year orbiting Jupiter, and NASA is even going to ask the public to vote on where it should point its camera. In August, a total solar eclipse will sweep across the nation, and later this year, the Cassini mission ends by plunging into Saturn's atmosphere. I'm Erwin Gratz, and today Maine Calling looks to the stars and planets and more. But first, this news update. And from the Maine Public Broadcasting Radio Studios, I'm Erwin Gratz, and you're listening to Maine Calling. Well, if you need a break from all the political news that's been dominating the airwaves or your social media news feed, you're in luck. Today we're going to stay away from politics. Matter of fact, we're going to get quite far away from politics, talking about the year ahead in astronomical happenings. With me in the studio is our resident astronomer, Edward Gleason. He is, not surprisingly, both an astronomer and manager of the Southworth Planetarium at the University of Southern Maine, and joining us from the Minnesota Public Radio Studio in Collegeville, Minnesota, is Nancy Atkinson. She's a contributing editor for Universe Today and author of Incredible Stories from Space, a behind-the-scenes look at the missions changing our views of the cosmos. As always, we want to hear from you. Are you an amateur astronomer? If so, what's your favorite celestial body to scope out? You can give us a call. Our phone number here is 1-800-399-3566. You can send brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Now, before we get underway here, I do want to take a moment to remember Gene Cernan, the last astronaut to stand on the lunar surface. His funeral was Tuesday. He was, among his other traits, an eloquent advocate for those who want to see more human spaceflight. Cernan was in Portland nearly 3 years ago, where I and a couple of other reporters chatted with him for about a half an hour. He had come to be a speaker at an event to raise money for children. Children, he said, are ready to reach farther into the universe if only we would let them.
Yeah, I think there's kids out there, you know, waiting for the opportunity. We need to provide them with the knowledge, the inspiration to take us back where we belong. That's what it's really all about.
And you can hear him banging the table there for emphasis. You know, I went to the downtown Holiday Inn by the Bay that afternoon, not knowing exactly where the press event would be. And as I was waiting to talk to one of the desk clerks, here coming around the corner is Cernan, walking towards the desk with the exact same question. Gene Cernan flew on a Gemini mission, taking one of the very first spacewalks, flew Apollo 10's lunar module close to the moon's surface, and then spent 3 days on the moon in 1972. And he died recently at, I believe, 80.
Right. He was in his early 80s, I believe.
Anyway, on to other things. You know, we haven't gone as far as Gene would have liked yet, but we are still exploring the possibilities aboard the International Space Station in Earth orbit. Edward, what they've been doing up there recently?
They've been doing a lot of research, and what's very exciting, which is coming up very soon, is they're going to be installing the Cold Atom Laboratory. It's a laboratory that is going to attain the lowest temperatures ever attained by humans. They can't actually attain absolute zero, but they can be very close to it. And by attaining these low temperatures, they're hoping to observe behaviors they've never seen exhibited before, because life becomes very strange as you get close to, like, within nanokelvins, even closer of absolute zero. So that's going to be put on the International Space Station. They're working on it now. I believe it's going to be deployed this year or next, and they're going to find a lot more about the universe. Ironically enough, they're going to find out more about it by observing the very small, because right now we're at room temperature, and everything behaves macroscopically. But when you're getting down to those low temperatures, to that kind of, things become very strange. And
well, just as an example, that's where you get some superconducting materials. Materials that often would be resistant to electricity suddenly become
conductors. They offer no resistance at all. That's one example. That's one practical example of ultra-low temperatures. They're hoping also to actually be able to observe quantum behavior. Just quickly, we have macroscopic behavior, but the world of the very small is very strange, actually very counterintuitive. Richard Feynman was on record for saying nobody understands quantum mechanics. And they're hoping that if they can observe behaviors at those low temperatures, they might actually directly observe some quantum behaviors, which is actually very exciting.
So I'm kind of curious, I mean, what is the advantage of placing a laboratory like that in orbit? It's not really, I mean, it's pretty cold in space outside the space station, but it is nowhere near as cold as the temperatures I think they're going to try to get to.
As I understand it, you can put it into an environment that you wouldn't have on Earth. You can actually get it away from the gravitational effects as well. As minute as they are, when you put it in a microgravity environment, then it's less problematic because they have to get it away from a gravity field. And the International Space Station, even though it's experiencing almost as much gravity as we are because it's in a microgravity environment, it's negated. And that's one of the advantages of putting the laboratory up there.
Okay, that makes sense. Nancy, one of the things I noticed, I was looking over the launch manifest over the next year, and normally they've been replacing crews on the International Space Station three at a time, which is the carrying capacity of the Soyuz spacecraft, but a couple of them are going up with only two cosmonauts. Do you know why?
Yeah, Russia is going to be cutting back on their crew members to try to save money. Mm. They're trying to save enough money to finish building and finally launch their long-delayed science module. So the U.S. has a lab up there. Europeans and Japanese each have their own labs. And Russia's lab was supposed to be launched several years ago. And, you know, I'm not sure how long the ISS is going to continue to be funded. I think 2024 is the last data I've heard, but so Russia wants to get it launched so that they have more than just a couple years of use out of it. So Roscosmos, the Russian space agency, they're cutting back on their yearly Progress cargo resupply launches. They usually have four. They're going to go down to three, and they say that's not enough to support the usual six cosmonauts per year. And they said that, you know, two cosmonauts at a time, so four per year, are needed to maintain the Russian segment. They said this was just a temporary measure until the science module gets launched and that they'll return to the three cosmonaut crews. So and the launch is coming up. The one in April will only have two people aboard, which is very unusual. But the rest of them, there's going to be four crew launches this year, and the rest of them will be filled with, there's an Italian coming up along with one Russian and one American, and the other launch has a Japanese member. I'm not sure who's going up on the fourth one.
Yeah, and then I guess the other thing that will happen perhaps as early as next year is we'll begin to see the commercial crew capsules that are being built by the American companies begin to ferry astronauts up there as well.
Yeah, set for August 24th of this year, there's an uncrewed Dragon test flight, SpaceX's Dragon. That'll be really interesting. Right now, the only way for humans to get up to the space station is the Soyuz launches. But, there's cargo flights. This might be of interest for anybody who's going to Florida on a spring break trip or something. There's currently scheduled, SpaceX is going to be sending up a Dragon cargo flight sometime in February. They don't have a firm date. Also, another one in June and August. And then the orbital ATK Cygnus cargo ship will be launching on March 16th, so that's prime spring break time.
Interesting. And I know coming up over this weekend are some reasonable opportunities to see the space station pass overhead in the evening. We'll have to provide a link to the information from NASA about when those all are.
And it's wonderful, too, because it looks like a very bright star. Now, mm-hmm. some people are hoping they can actually see the solar panels. You really can. They can see the reflection, and because the International Space Station is completing an orbit at once every 90 minutes, you can actually see direct motion of the object across the sky. And it's a beautiful thing to see, and sometimes it's brighter than others, but it's often a beautiful evening sight and a morning sight as well.
Yeah. All right, let's talk about a couple other things. Let us look a little farther afield to the giant planet Jupiter. We have a space probe that has arrived there now called Juno. Let's talk about the goals of this mission. And Nancy, why don't we start with you? What are some of the goals for Juno?
Sure. They're looking to kind of investigate Jupiter's origin. So they're going to look at the interior structure, its atmosphere, its magnetosphere. And the great thing about Juno is that it's closer than any other spacecraft has ever been before. So the radiation environment at Jupiter is really harsh. So this mission is only going to last for I believe, about 20 months. So it's, it's a short mission, but they're hoping to accomplish a lot. There's 8 different science instruments on board. And the really cool one that I think is an instrument that wasn't planned to be part of the mission at all. So when the mission planners were putting the idea for what they wanted to accomplish together, they really didn't have a camera on board. But of course, we all know that the images are really what gets the public's attention. So they did include a camera, but they decided to make it just completely a public device, I guess you would call it. And so they're letting the public choose the locations where they take the images, and then they make the raw data available, and people can download the raw data and process the images. And one of the scientists involved, Candy Hansen, said this is science in a fishbowl because they're letting the public see what it's like to be a scientist.
Yeah, it's interesting. What kinds of, we don't know that much about Jupiter yet. There certainly should be questions people can still have that may be answerable by photographs taken at Jupiter in close range.
Well, it's always great to be able to monitor the storms on Jupiter, and being able to do that from close up will really be revolutionary, I think. Just this week, they released an image of Jupiter, and I called it the best image ever taken of Jupiter ever, because it was just absolutely stunning. The swirling cloud tops, and in the picture was the little red spot. We haven't got a great picture of the big red spot yet, but I don't know if you can post a link to it on your website,
yeah,
so people can see it.
Can.
It's just really, really stunning.
Interesting.
And because it's a planet outside in our solar system, it's so large, they're still slightly speculating about what its interior is like and based upon how chemicals behave. Having that kind of reconnaissance, reading some of the radiation emitted from it, it will give them more insight into its interior. And again, we're still a little bit fuzzy about Earth's interior. They have a fair idea of the layers. But again, as you say, if you go by Jupiter because of the Io toroid, because of the little radiation between its moon Io, they're learning a lot more about it, its interaction with its many moons and its interior, and also the red spot itself. The red spot has been diminishing. It's a storm that's been seen for hundreds of years, and they're still trying to figure out the dynamics of Jupiter's weather. So there's a lot still to be found, and we have the disadvantage of being about 400 million miles away from it, and that's why the probe itself and the other probes have been there, like Galileo, have given us more information pertaining to Jupiter, its interior, and how it affects its surroundings.
Fascinating. All right, let's back up a little bit to the red planet Mars. We still have at Mars 2 rovers, Opportunity and Curiosity, operating on its surface, and then additional probes in orbit around the planet. Nancy, what are some of the most recent things we're learning there?
Well, Opportunity is just the Energizer bunny of Mars rovers. It's been going for 13 years now. We celebrated its 13th anniversary. Somebody was saying it's bat mitzvah this year because it's 13. So it's
okay.
Interesting. It's at a crater that it's been at for a couple of years now, and it's just been going around the rim of the crater, looking at various things. It keeps finding these bright soils underneath the surface. You know, we know Mars is kind of this dark red surface, but underneath, when the wheels kick up some dirt or some regolith, they're finding these white, bright soils, which, from all indications, they're salts or. So it seems like there was water there at one time, and these salts are left over from water evaporating away.
Okay, interesting. Edward, anything to add?
Again, it's always a precursor as well to, as we were speaking about Eugene Cernan before, about human missions to Mars. Mm-hmm. That's something we still haven't done yet. And what will be helpful is to know what the terrain is like, what the resources will be available to us. And so that's part of the mission, the science of how Mars, its origin, its water supply, why it was depleted and where it's gone, and what will be available for future human missions should people actually go there eventually.
All right. You know,
and that's what the Curiosity rover has been working on finding, too. because basically everywhere the rover looks, it's finding evidence of past water on Mars, and that's really intriguing because, as we know on Earth, everywhere we have water, we have life. So all indications are from very early on in the mission, you know, they were finding things like sandstone and mudstone, which are normally laid down in water, and also these rounded pebbles, which the only way that those could be formed was by flowing water. And they're just finding all sorts of layered rock formations, and it's now climbing the mountain, Mount Sharp, in the middle of Gale Crater. And I think what they're finally determining is that Gale Crater used to be a big lake, and there's a system of former rivers that flowed into it, and they're just seeing all these different sedimentary layers on this mountain, and they're seeing how the layers are changing as they go up, and all these, and the really interesting thing, I think, is that so all these different layers were laid down in water, and the processes to do that take millions of years. So that means that water just wasn't there, you know, because of some cataclysmic event on Mars. It was water that was there for long term, for millions of years. So that means that, you know, it was probably millions of years ago that Mars was once warm and wet. And, of course, had a thicker atmosphere like Earth. So being able to find more about that is going to be really intriguing. And the longer the rover can go, the longer and, you know, the more information that we'll be able to get from that.
And also, if I could add just very quickly, if you also find evidence of microbial life on Mars, that has profound ramifications for life in the universe, because so far we have direct evidence that we have life on this one planet. Knowing that life could develop elsewhere where the conditions are conducive to life means that as we're finding more exoplanets in the galaxy, there's a higher probability that maybe life will form elsewhere if its formation is a natural consequence of the formation of a world that is suitable to harbor it.
All right. Let's take a quick break. I've got phone lines full of questions for you guys, so we'll take those when we come back. Your comments and questions straight ahead. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Dirigo Pines in Orono, offering a spectrum of retirement living options on a 68-acre wooded campus. DirigoPines.com.
Next time on Living on Earth, elusive grizzly bears hiding deep in the desert and the man who went to find them.
What I've done is write a book about a bear nobody knows exists in a country not a lot of Americans pay much attention to.
The Gobi Grizzly and How It Survives. I'm Helen Palmer, and that's next time on Living on Earth from PRI.
Join us for Living on Earth coming up Sunday morning at 7 o'clock.
This is John Lithgow. I love telling a great story, almost as much as listening to one. Get your story fix this week on Selected Shorts from PRI, Public Radio International.
Coming to the Maine Public Radio weekend schedule in February, visit mainepublic.org, click on radio, or visit mainepublic.org/weekend.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Erwin Gratz. Today on the program, some the latest news from out of this world in the year ahead. On the line with us is Nancy Atkinson. She's a contributing editor for Universe Today and author of incredible stories from space, a behind-the-scenes look at the missions changing our views of the cosmos. In the studio with me, Edward Gleason. He's an astronomer and manager of the Southworth Planetarium at the University of Southern Maine. We invite you to join the conversation. You can call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. So let's go to the phones. We're going to start by talking with Ada. She's with us from Kittery. Ada, good afternoon. You're on Maine Calling. Hello.
Hi, I'm actually calling on behalf of Ada.
Excellent.
And her question was, how fast do asteroids fly?
Okay, good question. Edward.
Well, it depends on where they are. The asteroids in the asteroid belt are going very, very quickly, thousands of miles per hour. And the farther away the asteroids are from the sun, the slower they'll be moving. And so, again, the closer they are, the ones like the Apollonian asteroids, the one that crossed Earth's orbit, can be going very, very quick, over 100,000 miles an hour as a consequence of their motion on the sun. So They're going very, very quickly. Now, if she's worried that one's going to hit us, we can allay her fears somewhat by assuring her that no asteroid large enough to do any real damage are known to be close by. And if they are coming, astronomers at this point will probably know that they're on their way and might be able to do something to divert them. So they're moving very quickly, but we're not in any danger of what they call potentially hazardous asteroid anytime soon.
All right. Does that answer the question?
Yes, thank you very much.
Super. Thank you for the call. We appreciate it. Let's go to Ellery, I think it is, in Waterville. Ellery, good afternoon. You're on Maine Calling.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I have a question for Dr. Gleason about a thing close to home, close to Maine. I've been told I have my head in the clouds for a long time, but one question was about a meteor from last year that flew over the southern western mountains. I was wondering if by any chance bits of that made any landfall. And the other question is whether or not I heard talk of a meteorite museum or a rock and mineral meteorite museum in western Maine, and I haven't heard any more about that. I was wondering if there's any more information.
Well, I can answer the second question easily by saying I don't know. There could certainly be one. I haven't heard of it. Yes, it was that meteorite. They were offering money for it for about a 2-pound sample, which means you had a lot of people hiking in western Maine looking for it. But I don't know if anybody has recovered any pieces. It's always difficult to know because you don't really need that large of a piece to survive the descent. But it went into a lot of wilderness. I haven't heard of anybody finding any peace yet. It still could be there. And again, that's why, very, very quickly, that's why a lot of people who are hunting meteorites look in Antarctica, because when a meteorite lands there, it stays. There's not a lot of erosion. When you find something in such a beautiful area like western Maine with a lot of trees and forests, it can be concealed very quickly, even over a year's growth. So then nothing yet, but keep looking.
Okay. All right. Ellery, thank you for the question. We appreciate it. I want to talk about another one of the planetary missions that are out there, Nancy, and it's the one called Cassini, which has had a very rich history and has been orbiting the planet Saturn for a long, long time. Bring us up to date with what Cassini has been doing at Saturn.
Yeah, it's been just an amazing mission. Cassini's been at Saturn for 13 years now. The thing about it is, it's really just revolutionized the way that we understand the moons and the rings, and it's just the pictures from this are just absolutely stunning. I call them art museum quality pictures, and I do actually have some of them hanging on my wall. The thing about this mission is, though, sadly, it's coming to an end. It's getting low on rocket fuel that it needs to maneuver around Saturn's rings and moons, and eventually they won't be able to control the spacecraft. And that's an issue because NASA has a policy of what's called planetary protection. They don't want to contaminate any planetary body that could have the potential of having possible life. And there's the potential that Earth microbes might still be on the spacecraft, and they might be still surviving, even though the radiation in space and at Saturn, that's kind of unlikely. But NASA has chosen to what they call safely dispose of the spacecraft in the atmosphere of Saturn. The kind of the concern at the Saturn system is there are two moons there, Enceladus and Titan, and they're on the short list of possible places for life in our solar system. Especially from Enceladus, the data from Cassini has shown that there's the potential. There's geysers that are shooting out ice and water, and there's a possible subsurface ocean on Enceladus that's about 6 miles deep. So,
and those are both discoveries that Cassini has made. Our
correct.
Previous reconnaissance didn't indicate those geysers of water coming off of Enceladus.
Yeah, when I was out at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory doing interviews for the book, I got to talk to Earl Mays, who's the project manager, and he said originally they had one or two flybys of Enceladus planned, and after they found these geysers on there, they quickly retooled the mission, and they've had around 25 flybys now of Enceladus. No more coming up in the mission. They did their last one last fall. So, yeah, it really kind of reprioritized their mission, and there's just some really, really wonderful images of these geysers shooting out into space. It's just stunning.
And because the mission is getting near the end, and so there's less to lose, these last few orbits that Cassini will make are also going to take them inside the ring plane, between the rings and Saturn itself, which should also be kind of interesting, if nothing else, interesting visually.
Oh, yeah, and even now, so they've done some maneuvers where they're coming closer to the rings, and the images are just amazing. We've all seen, or maybe at least those of us really interested in space exploration, have seen these images of Saturn's rings, and they have scalloped edges on them, and that's because some of the moons within the rings are interacting with the ring material, creating these kind of scalloped edges. Last week, they released a close-up picture, and it's just amazing to see this small moon, Daphnis, and how it's affecting the rings with these huge scallops on them. But yeah, this, you know, in I guess I don't remember the exact date, but in a month or so, they're going to be going in that small gap between Saturn's cloud tops and the innermost ring, and they're going to make those final but close-up observations that. It's going to help them to figure out the mass of Saturn itself. We don't really know that. We've got the mass of both Saturn and its rings together, but we don't have Saturn by itself. So, I mean, that'll give us the mass of the rings as well. But, yes, September 15th is the date where the spacecraft will kind of plunge down into Saturn, and it'll be destroyed by the heat and pressure of the planet. So that's going to be a sad day.
Yeah. We've got an email message from Eric, who's asking about the two Voyager spacecraft, 1 and 2. Last he knew, they were near the edge of our solar system and about to enter interstellar space. He's wondering if any data is still coming back from either spacecraft. The answer to that question is there is some. Edward?
But here, I'm going to probably defer to Nancy. I know that there's some. I just don't know exactly what it would be.
Yeah, I was going to say. So what's the latest we're hearing from those two?
They are actually considered to be in interstellar space. They're able to, now I'm trying to remember exactly how they describe this. They're able to determine the kind of environment that they're going through just because of how the spacecraft, how the signals from the spacecraft are coming back. And I don't understand that fully enough to answer that question that way. But, yeah, the spacecraft does send back a signal every day, or each of them do, just kind of a ping to let them know that they're still going. I think they expect to be able to hear from the spacecraft for about another 10 years.
Yep.
And then after that, it'll just be a silent emissary to the cosmos for us.
Yeah, they're operating with those radio thermal isotope generators. The power level continues to slowly decline, and at some point in about 10 years or so, there won't be enough to take any measurements or radio a signal back.
Well, it's interesting because the Interstellar Boundary Explorer, which is an Earth-Moon orbit that's collecting energized neutralized particles from the heliosphere, they don't actually have anything at the heliosphere, so having the Voyagers there. Yeah, it's an in-person, like, you know, at Jupiter. So I'm sure they're probably going to find out a lot of things about the heliosphere that they can't know merely from the analysis of those energized neutralized particles with LIBEX.
Yeah, and for those of us who are not of astronomers, the heliosphere is kind of that region around the sun, helio,
yes.
That we consider to be its influence.
That's right. Yeah. It's being repelled by the gases of interstellar space.
Yeah. All right. Let's see. Let's go back to the phones here. Just a moment. Let's go to Anthony in Waterville. Anthony, good afternoon. You're on Maine Calling.
Yeah, I heard Maine has a tough light pollution law and that lights can't be pointed upward. Is that true?
I don't know if it's a law. I remember they try to encourage people to have downward focused lights. Although, to be honest, some municipalities might have some laws prohibiting a lot of light pollution. I don't know if it's a state law or not. I'm assuming it would be in a municipality by municipality, if I'm not mistaken.
I think that's correct at this point. I don't think there's a
I'll
state
defer to
statute.
Irwin for
but,
this.
we're going to have to double check that and perhaps get back to you. All right. Thanks, Anthony. Appreciate the call. All right. Let's see. Let's press that there. Okay. Let's go to Nancy in Portland. Nancy, good afternoon. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. I was in a quandary whether to call or not due to the political atmosphere in our country at present. But many years ago, I'm 67, so this is many years ago, there was a program on public television regarding the sun. And I remember that they said in the early 20th century that there would be several strong solar flares from the sun. And I was wondering if anybody has an idea as to when those are to occur and how they will affect the Earth's climate. When this program was aired, there was no such thing as global warming. So
okay. I think, Nancy, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think you're talking about the early 2000s, which would be the early 21st century, but nonetheless.
No, I'm not over 100 years old.
Yeah, I didn't think so.
Yeah, no, you're
I don't
right.
sound
yeah.
a day over, you know, whatever. Okay, Edward.
Well, there's no way to predict when solar flares will occur. What they do with one exception, they can see when they're occurring, and then a couple days later, for instance, when a coronal mass ejection occurs, because the sun is about 8.4 light minutes away, they can see when it's occurring almost instantaneously, and then it takes a couple of days for material to come to us. Now, solar flares, if they're powerful enough, if they're an X-class flare, can affect us quite profoundly because we're so dependent on this satellite electronic infrastructure. But it would take a lot. So, unfortunately, we don't know exactly when they will occur. We can't tell you that there'll be a powerful flare in November. But if they see them, they'll know a couple of days in advance until the particles from that coronal mass ejection hit Earth.
But we also do know that the sun goes through cycles of activity, does it not? So there
yes.
are times when solar flares are perhaps more likely than others?
Exactly. Ordinarily, it goes through this 22-year cycle of peaks. But right now, we're going through a strange minimum, and solar scientists are perplexed as to why this is occurring. And you're right, when there are more sunspots, when it's more active, you have a higher probability of solar flares occurring. So right now there seems to be a strange quiescence of the sun that solar astronomers are at a loss to explain.
Now, have astronomers made any links between this and global climate conditions?
Well, that's strange because there's something called the Maunder Minimum, which happened between 1645 and 1715. In that time period, in that 70 years, you would have ordinarily had about 50,000 sunspots. And they realized that there were far, far fewer. And that happened to correspond to a time period called Europe's Little Ice Age. Now, they don't know if that was a correlation or a causation. They don't know if that just happened at the same time or if there is a relation between the sunspot activity and the climate. Of course, we're dependent on the sun, the solar constant. It stays constant with some variation. It's less in July when we're farther away from the sun, a little bit more in January when we're closer. But they still don't know if the sunspot cycle has any effect on our climate at all. The climate, as you know, is so complex with so many factors, it's really difficult to isolate one factor to determine how influential it is.
Right. If you'd like to join our conversation here, the phone number is 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Our email address is talk@mainpublic.org. Or you can tweet us at Maine Calling. Nancy, I wanted to ask you about NASA is going to be launching another space-based telescope. This one's called the James Webb Telescope. It's actually been talked about for a long time. It's finally due to be launched next year, about October of 2018. What's that all about?
Well, it's been touted as the successor to the Hubble Space Telescope. But it's kind of a different telescope. It's a infrared telescope, and so the pictures that we get back are going to be different. But I think they'll be just as enticing and stunning. It's an infrared telescope that's got a 6.5 meter primary mirror, and it's an international mission. So it's interestingly enough, it's going to be launched on an Ariane 5 rocket from French Guiana. So it's kind of a group effort here of getting it into space. And astronomers are really excited about this. It's going to study pretty much every phase of astronomy, so from the history of our universe, and I think it's going to be able to look back at some of the first glows after the Big Bang to the formation of our own solar system. And also it's going to be able to look at look at other atmospheres of exoplanets that we're finding with other missions. And so it's going to be kind of a general purpose observatory. And it's going to be run the same way that the Hubble Space Telescope is run, where astronomers from around the world can submit applications to use it, and it can also be used as to look at some of the hot topics, or if something kind of weird pops up in the solar system or in the universe, they can take a look at it quickly. So it's going to be located a million miles away from Earth at what's called the second Lagrange point. It's out past the moon where gravity.
Explain. Yeah, okay, good.
Yeah, it's out past the moon where the gravity from the Earth and the moon and the sun provide a stable place to put things and for it to kind of hang out there. And what that means, though, is that it can't be serviced like the Hubble Space Telescope was. So, it's a really, really complex telescope, and that's why it's taken so long to be built. And I heard a kind of an interesting story now. It's basically built and ready to go, except that they have to put it through a bunch of testing, not only testing to have it deploy in space, but to withstand the rigors of launch and all those kind of things. So yeah, they recently were doing some vibrations tests to make sure it was going to be okay, and they had some issue prop up, but I think they had that resolved now, and they've resumed the vibration tests now. Mm. So yeah, it's been long awaited, and people are really looking forward to it.
And thanks to some really incredible engineering, there may also be some limited opportunity at the beginning for joint observations with the Hubble, which is still functioning.
Right, yeah. I got to go out to the Space Telescope Science Institute out in Maryland, and yeah, they were just putting together the control room for the James Webb Telescope, and they're really excited about being able to use it, the two telescopes in conjunction, because they said it'll be, you know, both telescopes together are better than either one of them alone, even though we've known how wonderful the Hubble Space Telescope has been for years and years now.
All right. Let's take another short break, and when we return, we've got more of your comments and questions. Please stay with us.
It's a problem across New England. Patients waiting a long time for mental health services in a place that's not really meant for them, the ER.
I mean, can you imagine that happening with a heart condition? It's really inhumane.
We'll look at what's being done, and we'll also bring you a tale of gentrification and change in two city squares. Join us for next from the New England News Collaborative.
Join us for next coming up at 2 o'clock this afternoon.
How do movies get made? For a striking number of Oscar winners, it involves an anonymous survey called The Blacklist.
Hollywood's a huge machine, and the people that are still greenlighting the majority of films tend to be overwhelmingly white and overwhelmingly male.
I'm Ari Shapiro. How to get out of a comic book superhero sequel-filled rut? Later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us for All Things Considered with Nora Flaherty from 4 to 6:30 each weekday evening.
And welcome back. I'm Erwin Gratz. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, news from out of this world. On the line with us, Nancy Atkinson, a contributing editor for Universe Today and the author of Incredible Stories from Space, a behind-the-scenes look at the missions changing our views of the cosmos. In the studio with me, Edward Gleason, an astronomer and manager of the Southworth Planetarium at the University of Southern Maine. You can join our conversation by giving us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Let's go to the phones now. Ralph is in Belgrade. Ralph, good afternoon. You're on Maine Calling. Ralph?
Space, the final frontier, huh?
Yeah.
A little disappointed. We went to the moon 53, 54 years ago. And then our space program kind of stopped or slowed down dramatically. And I kind of fault the relationship with corporate America, the government, and the people together. The greed for profits might be getting in the way of us, you know, going into the last frontier here. So it really... disappointing, a renaissance, kind of the toppling of the Roman Empire, you might say. World went into a renaissance for 2,000 years into the darkness. I hate to sound like this, but we should be outside our solar system right now.
Well, that's interesting. You know, one of the a couple of points that I think are worth mentioning. One, it is interesting to watch the continuing development of private businesses like SpaceX, and I think it'll be an interesting question as to whether when that next expedition heads off to Mars, whether that actually winds up being another government program like Apollo or whether it might be something involving a private entity.
There seems to be a fusion between private enterprise and the government organizations to put people into space and other missions. And if I could just very quickly give a recommendation for the book that Nancy wrote, The Incredible Stories from Space, because the producer sent me a copy. If you want to know more about the space program, a reason I'm mentioning this now is the fellow seemed to be rather dour about it. The space program is exciting, and this book that Nancy wrote is very readable and gives you a lot of information about it. And it's very hopeful, very lot of exciting things, and thank you very much, Nancy, for writing it.
Okay, and Ralph, thank you. Thank you for your comment. We got a posting to our Facebook page from Bill, and this kind of falls under the heading of All Things Are Relative. He said back when the shuttle program was still active, he's seen the International Space Station pass by with the shuttle in hot pursuit. He said that was a really amazing sight, very exciting, and thinks that it's just remarkable that people are still living in space, in Earth orbit. So there you go. Let's go to Dakota in Machias. Dakota, good afternoon. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You're welcome.
I was just wondering if there was any estimation currently about any amount of time to when we would have humans on Mars.
Good question. Nancy, you want to take a guess?
Yeah, that is a good question. There's a couple of private endeavors that are going on, the Mars One project, and also SpaceX is really interested in going to Mars.
Elon Musk has said that he might actually launch a Dragon capsule unmanned to Mars like by 2024.
Yeah, it's really interesting. So, yeah, there's a lot of technological hurdles, though, to actually get humans to the surface. So Curiosity is the biggest piece of equipment that we've dropped there, and it had to use this really kind of amazing technology of the sky crane. But to get payloads the size that we need for humans, we really don't know how to do that yet. The Martian atmosphere is thin enough that parachutes won't work like they work on Earth, and it's thicker than what we, of course, the moon didn't have any atmosphere, and so it's got just a thick enough atmosphere that propulsive technology like they use to land the landers on the moon, that just won't work. So it's actually a big technological hurdle of how to get these large payloads to the surface. And, they tried testing out something called an inflatable, inflatable torus. I can't remember the name of it right now, but they didn't have really good results. They tested that in the upper portion of Earth's atmosphere, which would be about, the same thickness of what's at Mars, and it really didn't work out all that well. So I'm not sure. That was the last time I talked to somebody at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. That kind of torus, inflatable torus, was the best hope on the horizon, and that's really not. And I don't hear the SpaceX people and the Mars One people talking about these issues.
Yeah.
So yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, let's go ahead to another call. This is Ryan in Standish. We're going to look a little farther afield this time. Ryan, good afternoon. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. How you doing?
Good.
I got a question on a theory of mine. I'm by no means anything but an amateur. I was watching a NOVA documentary on dark energy and the expansion of the universe and how it's we all understand that it is expanding, and in fact it's actually accelerating in its expansion, and nobody really knows why. Could we assume that outside of the known universe, farther than anything has actually expanded to, is in an absolute vacuum? And that vacuum is actually pulling on the edges of the known universe? Am I crazy?
Oh, not crazy at all. The interesting thing is, when you talk about the edge of the universe, it's really difficult to use the word outside, because outside is a spatially relative term. because we know that the entire the space itself is expanding. Now, that having been said, there's been the M-brain theory, the idea that what we perceived as a Big Bang, the beginning of the universe, was not a singularity, but was the interaction of membranes in a hyperdimensional universe pulling the universe apart. So what you're saying is not crazy at all. It actually seems to be consistent with the notion that our universe wasn't born in a Big Bang, but actually as an interaction of M-brains. So they don't know because, again, dark energy, the acceleration of the expansion was something they did not expect to observe in the late 90s, and that's what gave rise to the development of the dark energy theory, which is still trying to figure out, and they don't know exactly what it is, but they believe that it represents the majority of the universe, and they might find out that there's some force, there's something interacting with the universe they haven't even considered yet. So no theory is really that crazy when you're dealing with dark energy, which is rather enigmatic.
Now, you know, I was just reading just recently that they've just been awarding several contracts for a very large ground-based telescope called the ELT. Edward, one of the questions I have about that is, given when we talked about the James Webb Telescope, the Hubble, why are we still building big telescopes on Earth?
We're still building them because they developed a technology called adaptive optics. Adaptive optics will allow even a ground-based telescope to counteract atmospheric effects. The reason they put the Hubble Space Telescope in orbit was because it could circumvent all the atmospheric distortions that ground-based telescopes experienced. But now with adaptive optics, European Extremely Large Telescope, it's under construction. Its first light is due to be in 2024. It's on a mountaintop in Chile, and it'll be above a lot of the atmosphere. And with the adaptive optics, it can, because of its sizable mirrors, it has a primary, secondary, and tertiary mirror system, it will be able to get images much sharper even than the Hubble Space Telescope. Its altitude will counteract a lot of the absorption. Adaptive optics can't counteract the absorption of the atmosphere. But if it's high enough with adaptive optics, it will really be able to capture some impressive images. And hopefully, because of the mirror, because it's much harder to get a mirror that size, it's going to be an enormous set of hexagonal mirrors. Yeah. You'll be able to hopefully image a lot of the larger extrasolar planets and be able to perhaps do some research into dark energy by looking at the redshifts of distant galaxies. And so there's still a lot you can do with ground-based telescopes because of adaptive optics.
Okay. Nancy, I've got about 90 seconds left. So I guess, and there's so much more we can talk about, is there any one particular development on the horizon that you want to tell us a little bit about before we go?
Oh, let's see. The New Horizons mission, it flew past Pluto about a year and a half ago, and that mission, even though it flew by Pluto and that part of the mission is done, it's not over by any stretch of the imagination. So there, I just heard that they're currently looking at a bunch of Kuiper Belt objects. They've turned on their cameras, and they were looking at them this week. So they're doing imaging and giving us a look at the Kuiper Belt that we've never been able to see before. And then in January of 2019, it's going to be flying by another object, a Kuiper Belt object that's much different from Pluto. So that's going to be really interesting. It's a darker object. Those pictures that we saw from Pluto was a brighter object. So it's really interesting, and they're hoping that this mission can keep going for quite some time and telling us more and more about the Kuiper Belt, something that we really don't know that much about.
Okay, great. Want to let you know we've had other folks who have called in. Thank you for that. I promise you we'll come back because there's lots more to talk about. We didn't even get to everything on my page today. It's always interesting to be talking about goings-on in outer space, and we look forward to doing that again sometime soon. Also, check out our Maine Calling Facebook page. There's an interesting post there as well about the sun as a radio object. Anyway, Nancy, Edward, thank you both for joining us today. Nancy Atkinson is a contributing editor for Universe Today and author of Incredible Stories from Space, a behind-the-scenes look at the missions changing our views of the cosmos. Edward Gleason is an astronomer and manager of the Southworth Planetarium at the University of Southern Maine. Jonathan Woodward ran the board today, and we had additional technical help from John Bradford and Dan Works. You can easily find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as a link to our audio archives, by visiting mainecalling.net. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Today's program will be rebroadcast this evening at 7 o'clock. I'm Erwin Gratz. You've been listening to Maine Calling right here on Maine Public Radio.